Greetings once again from Denver, Colorado, the city right here in the middle of it all. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview. I am your host, Doug McBurney. This is the Weekly Worldview, the heart of conservative talk on the internet. And it's so good to have you back on the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do take the events of the week and focus them through the lens of original thought. I want to know if anyone else out there has seen the commercial for the Chia Obama. Has anybody seen this? Is this serious? Or has someone played a joke on me? I was watching some late night television and I saw an ad for Chia Obama. You remember the Chia Pet? Well, the Chia Obama, though it doesn't look all that much like Obama. And then you've got the green hair that grows. And I'm just not sure that what I saw was real or serious. And so if someone out there could report to me whether or not they've purchased a Chia Obama. Because I remember my wife and I, Takako, my lovely audio engineer, who is again absent. And I am missing my baby. Oh, I tell you what, I am missing my baby. But anyway, my wife and I bought a Chia Obama for our eldest daughter. Not a Chia Obama, I'm sorry. A Chia Pet. We didn't buy a Chia Obama. At least not yet. We may buy one if indeed they're real. But we bought the Chia Pet, and frankly, it didn't work that well, and it was kind of messy. And after a couple of tries, we had to hide it from Nicole because it was just a messy disaster. But anyway, I saw this Chia Obama on late-night TV, and maybe it was a dream. Maybe it came to me in a dream. That's possible. So anyway, if someone could let me know if that's real or not, let's move on to the more serious news of the day, ladies and gentlemen. Got a story out of the Sunday London Times. A Japanese airline has started asking passengers to go to the toilet before boarding in a bid to reduce carbon emissions. Carbon emissions, they said. All Nippon Airways claims that empty bladders mean lighter passengers, a lighter aircraft, and thus lowers fuel use. Okay. Now, the airline began the policy on October 1st, and it's intended as an experiment to last 1 month, 42 flights. And they say that the trial may be extended if it's well received by passengers and if results are positive. Now, I've never needed encouragement to go to the bathroom before I got on a long flight. But maybe that's just me. Maybe, anyway, I find airplane bathrooms, along with public bathrooms in general, pretty disgusting. But airplane bathrooms specifically, because you're all cooped up in there, you know, and usually someone else was just in there. And it's just no fun, you know. So if there's any way to avoid that, I try to avoid it. But All Nippon Airways is encouraging people to empty their bladders, go to the bathroom in an effort to fight climate change, I suppose, to reduce the carbon footprint of each flight. Now, listen to these numbers, ladies and gentlemen. You may be surprised, and you may learn something here. Based on average human bladder capacity of 15 ounces, if 150 passengers relieve themselves on board an aircraft, this would amount to 140 pounds of waste. Shocking news, isn't it? Anyway, it just so happens that my extremely attractive audio engineer is flying on All Nippon Airways during the month of October. In fact, she flew after the first, so I'll have to ask her and the girls if they were clued in that they should go to the bathroom before they get on board. I'll get to the bottom of this story for the sake of society in general. All right, now, on to more serious news, ladies and gentlemen. We have a story from, I believe this is, it was on Ynet in Israel. Great site to check for Israel news, by the way, ynet.com. But I believe it comes from the London Sunday Times. Let's see here. In an interview given by former deputy defense minister from Israel, Ephraim Sneh, to the London Sunday Times, he said that if Iran were not further sanctioned by this Christmas, Israel would attack the country. Yeah. Now, Iran's ambassador to the UN, Mohammad Khazaei, then sent a letter of protest to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, in which he wrote that there is no explanation for Israel's continuing threats against Tehran. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm glad to hear that the Israelis, they must be listening to my show, because I believe I made the prediction last week that if someone does not bomb Iran by Christmas, they are going to bomb Tel Aviv. Maybe not Tel Aviv. I don't think I was that specific. They are going to explode a nuclear device and join the nuclear club, so to speak. So it's nice to see that the Israelis are, well, if they're not listening to the worldview, at least they're thinking clearly for some reason. And we certainly do appreciate that someone is doing that. And by the way, Mohammed is upset about Israel's continuing threats against Tehran. And I don't think Israel has threatened to wipe Iran off the map, at least not publicly. But it seems to me that I heard some prattling like that out of some Iranian official. I'm not sure. I think he's a college professor with poor taste in sport coats. But anyway, let us move on from the London Times. Again, boy, the London Sunday Times, it must be doing a good job this week. From the London Sunday Times, French agents have arrested a researcher from Europe's top atomic lab on suspicion of links to Al-Qaeda. The 32-year-old man, who was detained along with his brother, works for the prestigious European Organization for Nuclear Research in Geneva, Switzerland. Yeah, that's kind of scary. Let's see here. We've got a quote here from Brice Hortefeux, the French Interior Minister, and he says, "Perhaps we have avoided the worst possible scenario." Let's see. The suspect is believed to have been in contact with members of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, an Algerian-based terrorist organization which joined Osama bin Laden's network in 2007. According to French officials, he had expressed a wish or a desire to commit terrorist actions, but had not materially prepared them. Yeah, well, then, you know, can we really arrest him if all he wanted, he expressed a desire or a desire to commit terrorism? He doesn't actually have any bomb material in his possession. Can we really arrest him? I mean, he just had a wish to commit terrorist actions. Oh, well, wait a minute. There's precedence, because Barry Ho simply has a wish for world peace, and he got the Nobel Peace Prize. So I suppose if this fellow had a wish or a desire to commit terrorist actions, we can give him the prize of arresting him and hopefully surveilling all of his friends and associates and getting to the bottom of what seems to be a growing and reinvigorated Al-Qaeda terrorist Islamo-fascist movement. Seems like since Barry Ho was elected, these guys seem to be, I don't know, they've got the mo. You know, they've got some momentum. Things are happening in their groups. They're active. They're activated. And it's probably just a coincidence that Barry Ho was elected, and now we've got all this activity, chatter on the other side. Certainly don't want to imply any cause and effect relationship. I've got this next story out of Kabul from the Associated Press. One of the most depressing stories I've read this year. Dateline Kabul, U.S. forces have withdrawn from an isolated base in eastern Afghanistan that insurgents attacked in one of the deadliest battles of the war for U.S. troops. The pullout from the Kamdesh outpost near the Pakistani border is likely to embolden insurgent fighters in the region. Yeah, do you think? In fact, the Taliban swiftly claimed victory for forcing the coalition to leave and said they had raised the Taliban flag over the town. Now, according to the Associated Press, the withdrawal had been planned well before the October 3rd battle and is part of a wider strategy, Barry Ho's wider strategy there in the region. According to the AP, the U.S. was just days away from pulling out when the attack happened. Now what this tells me a couple of things. At least it makes me suspicious of a couple of things. I'm suspicious that the enemy had intelligence and knew that the U.S. was just days away from pulling out. That's why they timed this attack, so that our pullout would appear a victory to the enemy. As coalition forces were pulling out, they destroyed what was left of the outpost. And the action was likely taken, according to the Associated Press, to prevent insurgents from using the base. So, if your enemy has better intelligence than you do, and they attack an outpost and kill some of your men, and then you go ahead with the pullout and you destroy the base so the enemy can't use it, that is the technical description in military terms of a loss. And it hurts me to see this happening. I'm no military genius by any means, but if the enemy attacks a base that you were about to leave, it seems to me a mistake to then go ahead and leave and grant them a victory. In fact, that base should be reinforced and attacks should be sustained from that base until the war is over, at which point that base should be a memorial to the victory. But that doesn't seem to be the track Barry Ho is taking with the war. By the way, just a reminder, the Associated Press reminds us that in October, the United States entered its ninth year of war in Afghanistan, attempting, I think, to build a secular democracy in Afghanistan. Well, it's depressing to watch, frankly. All right. From NBC TV in Daytona Beach, Florida, on to much more serious news. More than 30 cats were rescued from a house fire sparked by carpenter ants this past Tuesday morning. Yeah, 9 cats were killed, and 2 were rushed to an emergency veterinarian's office. Rhonda Spivey lost her house in the fire. Some carpenter ants, according to officials, some carpenter ants were building a nest in the wall and hit an electrical outlet. And now, city law says that that's kind of a freak accident, right? That's the definition of a freak accident. City law says that Spivey can only keep 4 adult animals in her home, but she defended her role as a rescuer of cats. Animal Control was going to fine Spivey up to $4,000, but the police chief there said he thought that would be inappropriate, seeing as the cat rescuer had already lost her entire home. Police chief said she would not be fined, and she promised that she would not take in any more cats. My question, of course, just like yours, is anyone looking into the motive of these ants? I mean, are they going to be allowed to just get away with this? I demand an investigation. All right. Now, on to much less serious news. From Bob Unruh over at WorldNet Daily, atheists recruited to be part of a lawsuit that is trying to rid government ceremonies, such as the inauguration of a president, of any invocation or other prayer, have claimed that they are made physically ill by prayer. Let's hear. I have some quotes from some of the atheists. As I watched the inauguration, my stomach did a somersault with disgust for how much our country was violating the Constitution, the most important document in our country. That's from a 15-year-old alleged atheist in testimony being given to the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. So, he's watching the inauguration. He hears prayer. He gets physically sick about the fact that the prayer is violating the Constitution. Apparently, the fact that we're swearing in a Kenyan doesn't seem to bother him very much. Although, that's all just alleged. Let's see. The lawsuit was filed before President Barry Ho's inauguration and was subsequently dismissed at the district court level. Briefs are now being submitted to the appeals court in plaintiff's hopes that the case will be reopened. And let's see, do I have any more atheists that are quoted? One atheist said, "All the prayers made me feel excluded from the political process and a second-class citizen. But when Chief Justice Roberts asked the president to say, 'So help me God,' I felt threatened and sick to my stomach." That's an unnamed atheist there. Let's see. Now, officials with the Pacific Justice Institute, who are defending the Right Reverends Rick Warren and Joseph Lowery, who spoke at the inauguration of Barry Ho, said in their response that the Constitution simply does not require that the government be amoral or atheistic. Prayers designed to solemnize public events have a long and venerable history in our nation, said the Pacific Justice Institute Chief Counsel Kevin Snyder, who authored the brief rebutting the claims. You know, I think God probably gets a little sick to his stomach at this point with people like Rick Warren and Joseph Lowery, who seem to, purport to be somehow associated with God in some way, and I'm just not sure I see that. Now, this complaint was originally filed by a long list of people who described themselves as atheists, as well as the Freedom from Religious the Freedom from Religion Foundation, the American Humanist Association, Atheists United, Atheists for Human Rights, and the Military Association of Atheists and Free Thinkers. So this is this is like a who's who of people who are on their way straight to hell with jet rockets. Hey, where's the ACLU? Did I miss that? It would appear that the ACLU is not in on this lawsuit. Oh, and they must have been asleep at the wheel to miss this one. But hey, I want to go back to Reverend Rick Warren and Joseph Lowery, the Pacific Justice Institute. I want to just bring their attention to some scripture. So warning, Will Robinson, there are Bible verses up ahead. For those in the audience who advocate pluralism and diversity, we know here at the Weekly Worldview that you would not tolerate anyone who would dare ever quote a Bible verse in public. So this warning gives you fair notice that raw, unadulterated truth is about to be uttered. Let me take you to the book of Mark in the 7th chapter in the words of Jesus Christ himself. He says, "This people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me, and in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." Is the Weekly Worldview. I am Doug McBurney, so glad to be back with you. I am trying to get fired up. I'm trying, but, with my extremely attractive audio engineer absent and all my little girls over in Okinawa, I find it hard to get motivated by the news of the day, but I will soldier on and do my best here. I suppose I'm whining too much, but hey, you know what? I'm sitting here at home alone trying to figure out what am I going to thaw for dinner, and, I'm just not that happy, all right? Just bear with me. All right, let's see. Now, I mentioned earlier Barry Ho receiving the Nobel Peace Prize because he says he likes peace or wishes there were more peace or somehow visualizes world peace. And so I want to talk about people who were passed over. As soon as I heard that Barry Ho had won the Peace Prize, I wondered just who was passed over. Because my guess is it was probably some people who have dedicated their lives to legitimate efforts to bring peace to the world. And let's just go over some of these. Ken and Joe Scott were passed over. They have prevented over 1,000 murders directly right here in the United States of America as sidewalk counselors. Preventing women from going into Planned Parenthood and slaughtering their children. So Ken and Joe Scott were passed over. Seema Samar, She's a women's rights activist in Afghanistan. She kept schools and clinics open in Afghanistan even during the most repressive days of the Taliban, whose laws prohibited the education of girls past the age of 8. She was passed over because Barry Ho has a vision of peace, and he's something of a rock star, and he's not George W. Bush. Let's see, who else was passed over? Cal Zastro. Cal Zastro, leading personhood efforts across the country, a man who regularly smuggles Bibles into China at risk of life and limb. Cal Zastro passed over by the Nobel Committee. Who else? Dr. Denis Mukwege. He's the founder of Panzi Hospital in Bukavu, Congo. He has dedicated his life to helping Congolese women and girls who are victims of... I don't even want to say this. There's some things I don't want to say because I figure my kids are probably going to hear these shows at some point. Anyway, they're victims of organized governmental violence, systematic assault and violation. So here's a guy who's dedicated his entire life to that. But Barry Ho has a real winning smile, and he really wants world peace. So Dr. Mukwege was passed over. Hu Jia, human rights activist and outspoken critic of the Chinese government, was sentenced last year to 3.5 years in prison for inciting subversion of state power there in China. He was also passed over for the Barry Ho and his MO and all of that. Who else was passed over? Bob Enyart. Bob Enyart, pastor, he's the gentleman who gave the seminal Focus on the Strategy lecture to Focus on the Family back in 2005. He inspired personhood efforts in Colorado, serves as the fountainhead and spiritual counsel of the first human rights movement in history dedicated to protecting all innocent life, regardless of age, sex, race, religion, national origin. It's really the first one. If you go back and look at history, the personhood movement. Bob Enyart passed over by the Nobel Committee. Who else? Wei Jingsheng, who spent 17 years in Chinese prisons for urging reforms to China's communist system. He was also passed over. And Leslie Hanks and Guabe Garcia Jones, who reintroduced the Colorado Personhood Initiative here in Colorado, proving to all of our enemies that we are not going away, that we will keep coming. Leslie Hanks and Gualberto Garcia Jones passed over by the Nobel Committee in favor of Barry Ho. So there you have it. There's the state of the world right there. Now let's see. Let's go. I want to move into the culture file because the culture is falling apart before our very eyes, as wise men have predicted it would, since we basically have turned our back on God and dedicated ourselves to becoming a secular society, a secular democracy. Nay, shall I say it, a social democracy? Oh, we're getting so close to that. I want to talk about the public schools and the welfare state in general. Since 2005, according to the Chicago Sun-Times, dozens of Chicago's public schools have been closed and thousands of students reassigned to campuses outside their neighborhoods and often across gang lines. Yeah, the headline is, school closings may be root of Chicago teen deaths. School closings, that's the problem. When they close these schools, they now have to bus children across gang lines. It's part of a program called Renaissance 2010, a program launched by Mayor Richard Daley. Renaissance 2010. That name is akin to China's Cultural Revolution. You remember that? That's where millions of Chinese were starved to death, slaughtered, killed, brutalized, butchered. And they called it the Cultural Revolution. Well, in Chicago, they have a program in the schools called Renaissance 2010. And the kids are being killed by one another. At least not directly by governing officials. Just indirectly. Now, according to the Sun-Times, before the 2006 school year, an average of 10 to 15 public school students were fatally shot each year. By the way, 2006 was before the school closing started. Okay, so 10 to 15 public school students were fatally shot each year. That soared to 24 deadly shootings in the 06-07 school year, 23 deaths, and 211 shootings in the 07-08 school year, and 34 deaths and 290 shootings last school year there in beautiful Chicago. Yeah. So, well, one thing I want to say is, are they saying that 10 to 15 students shot and killed isn't a significant problem? I mean, you know you must be living in Chicago if you're longing for the days when only 10 or 15 students were slaughtered every year. Let's see. What else do we have? We have a quote here from T.O. Hardiman, director of the anti-violence organization Ceasefire Illinois. He says, "You have a trail of blood and tears ever since they launched Renaissance 2010. There's a history of violence associated with moving kids from one area to another." Oh, really? There is. Well, Mr. Hardiman, that's only in Chicago. Kids move, schools get closed all the time, and there's not a bloodletting in the streets. I think you might want to examine your government's social philosophy and the child-rearing techniques put into play there in Chicago, rather than looking at the schools being closed and the cultural revolution or whatever it is that you're trying to pull off there in Chicago. I don't think this fellow's looking in the right direction to apply blame. All right. More from Chicago. On the day, Attorney General Eric Holder and Education Secretary Arnie Duncan met with local officials to discuss youth violence, there was a giant street brawl at Fenger High School. Yeah, this is from CBS TV. They report, students said what happened is typical of what happens every day. Students from Altgeld Gardens got into a fight with students who live in the area surrounding the high school, the area that's known as the Ville. Not the hood, but the Ville. The CBS reporter says if Holder, Eric Holder, Education Secretary, Attorney General Eric Holder and Education Secretary Duncan and Mayor Daley had been outside Fenger when school let out, Fenger High School, students said they would have gotten an eyeful. Yeah, one girl said, "Yeah, they was fighting." That's what that's a quote from a girl. "Yeah, they was fighting." Meanwhile, protesters shouted, "We want Carver back." That's a high school that was closed there. Carver High School was closed. So they've got protests, they've got violence, they've got children clubbing each other to death in the streets, and the governing officials there in Chicago are wondering if it's closing the schools that's leading to all this bloodshed. I don't think I want to talk about that anymore. Let's go to Detroit, as if that's not depressing enough. Philadelphia, which is, well, six of one, half a dozen of the other. The school district of Philadelphia, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, will now hold principals accountable for the number of students eating breakfast in their schools. Yes, breakfast participation will be part of the report card that rates principals each year, along with categories such as attendance and math and reading performance. You notice the order that these data points are in. We're concerned first about breakfast, then about attendance, and then about math and reading. Yeah, that'll probably be a smaller portion of their score. Let's see, all 165,000 students in Philadelphia public schools, regardless of income, according to the Inquirer, are eligible for free breakfasts, but just 54,000 ate breakfasts last year. What a tragedy. So many Philadelphia children without government cheese. Oh, it just breaks my heart. Let's see. Jonathan Stein, a lawyer with Community Legal Services, whose efforts, along with those of Public Citizens for Children and Youth, helped bring about this new move to grade the principals on how many kids they can stuff government cheese into. They're just despondent. Now these must be community organizations, right? These are right out of Barry Ho's culture. Community organizations organizing communities so they can receive welfare and government handouts. Must be what that's all about. Let's see. They say this is the first accountability system for school meals in the history of the school system. It's very exciting. Really? Well, how about breakfast with mom? Has anyone thought about that in the Philadelphia school system? Oh, I suppose they don't want that. I don't think they get any government dough if the kids eat breakfast with mom. Let's see. Wayne Grisella, Senior Vice President of Food Services for the school district, said he's equally pleased. He says, "One of our main goals is to help improve a child's ability to learn. We're working with the principals to make this happen. They are already reaching out to us." Us. I'm sorry, I thought this guy was a robot. Anyway, he's like an automaton. But not everyone is happy with this new plan to grade the principals. Michael Lerner, president of the local Teamsters Union, he's upset. He says, "I think it's wrong to assume that no parent in Philadelphia is providing providing breakfast each day." And he's upset. Yeah. But you will assume that, sir. We are the government, and we are here to help. Anyway, I'm sure they could quell this Teamsters rage if they simply provide the Teamsters the appropriate kickback. It is the Weekly Worldview, and I am your host, Doug McBurney. So glad to have you with us as we're rounding second here and getting through the news of the day. The principals there in Detroit trying to feed the flock out there with government cheese. Let's move on to Detroit, as promised, as advertised. Let's see what's happening in Detroit. Well, they've got troubles. There's trouble in Detroit City. City officials said a total of about 65,000 people last week had gathered for applications for welfare. Yeah. Uh-huh. For a share of $15.2 million in federal stimulus money to help people avoid foreclosure or quickly rebound from homelessness. Now, according to city officials there in Detroit, ultimately as few as 3,500 people may receive help. So they announced some welfare there in Detroit, and 65,000 people show up with their hands out. And there was a huge crowd. There were scuffles. There was fights. People fainted and others fought as police tried to keep people calm and cooperative in line. Some waiting in line for 48 hours. One city council candidate said, "It's a disaster here." Yeah. He handed out bottles of water to people in line. He said, "This is dangerous, very unorganized, very dangerous." And he's a candidate for city council. Well, mister, get ready. Welcome to Detroit City. Man. By the way, joblessness in Detroit is approaching 30%. Wow. I mean, that has the makings of a regular social disaster there in Detroit, and one that's been a long time coming, and one that you were warned about. So, well, there you go. Now, let's move on to more important cultural news. Which one of these do I want to do first here? I want to do this first. This is from a blog on the internet called Ramparts that claims to be associated with Eagle Forum. Now, I wasn't able to confirm if this blog is actually related to Eagle Forum, but they certainly purport to be, and they're just as Catholic as the day is long. So, anyway, here's from the blog on, you know, supposedly associated with Phyllis Schlafly and Eagle Forum. The blogger says, "When a personhood referendum is on the ballot, conservative candidates lose. In Colorado in 2008, the personhood referendum received only 26.5% of the vote, and conservative Marilyn Musgrave, an incumbent, lost by the shocking margin of 56 to 44%. So she's blaming the utter decimation of the Colorado Republican Party on the fact that personhood was on the ballot. She says, she or he, this is an anonymous blogger. Congressman Bob Schaefer there in Colorado fared even worse, winning only 42.5% of the vote for an open U.S. Senate seat in Colorado. You know, I want to remind this anonymous blogger that neither of these candidates, at least Congressman Bob Schaefer, never endorsed the personhood amendment. And if Marilyn Musgrave endorsed it, which I believe she may have, she was quite quiet about it. Anyway, the blogger goes on. These devastating results have been seen in other elections. Jim Talent lost the U.S. Senate seat in 06 with a stem cell referendum on the Missouri ballot. Many seats have been lost in South Dakota due to misguided pro-life referenda there. Yeah. Now, she says that the pro-aborts outspend pro-lifers by a factor of 10, ensuring their defeat every time. The pro-life movement is best served by electing pro-life candidates. Yeah. You mean like the ones we've elected for the last 30 years who've restrained abortion? Have they even restrained it in any way? No. Anyway, but the folks at this blog, Ramparts, they're part of what has become known now as the pro-life industry, which, you know, there's an industry that kills children and makes a lot of money, and there's another industry that passes laws regulating the killing of children, and they seem to bring in a pretty good amount of money every year. And the pro-life movement is no longer associated with this industry. We've left this industry. We actually want to end legalized killing of innocent people. Yeah, we don't want to regulate it. So people like this blogger, who I hope is not associated with Phyllis Schlafly or Eagle Forum, I'm hoping that this is one of those websites that's set up to ride the coattails of other famous people. That's what I'm hoping. They say, let's see, what does the blogger say? There's a movement starting to put a personhood referendum on the ballot in Missouri, which will cost our candidates between 5 and 10% of the vote on Election Day. In Florida, the Catholic Church just unanimously opposed the personhood referendum and prohibited the collection of signatures for it in local churches. And this blogger is correct about that. We're going to get to that. But the decimation of the Republican Party in Colorado should be squarely blamed on the fact, first of all, that Colorado is a pretty liberal state full of queers and deviants and freaks and women who kill their children. And Dick Wadhams. Dick Wadhams, the Republican chairman out here, who should have been summarily fired at the end of the 2008 election, but it continues to lead the Republican Party over the cliff here in Colorado. So I believe this blogger must be from Missouri and doesn't know much about Colorado politics. But let's go to Florida now. Indeed, this is from RenewAmerica.com. The Florida bishops have chosen sides. The reporter tells us, in their fight against the proposed personhood amendment, the state's pro-abortion lobby is receiving indirect support from some unexpected quarters, the chanceries of all nine bishops who direct the Florida Catholic Conference. That's right. The Catholic Church, the leadership, opposes the idea that every human being has all the rights of a person from the moment of their beginning, of their biological development. Doesn't that strike anyone as odd? Maybe not. Maybe not. And I don't want to do any more on the Catholics. I sent an email to these people, and I prayed for them. Yes. Anyway, it wasn't a really nice prayer. No. It was a prayer of condemnation and hope for repentance. Now let's move on to the Billings, Montana Gazette. In a letter to the editor, this woman writes, I'm writing this letter in response to the September 25th Gazette story on the so-called personhood petition circulating in Montana. Contrary to claims made in the article, Montana has long been a state that values the right to privacy, including the right for women to make private medical decisions regarding their reproductive health. Oh, yeah, that's very insightful. What about the women who are about to be ripped limb from limb? Should they have a choice? Even if we only address the women who are in the womb, we could call them girls, call them female humans. Don't they have a choice? Anyway, the writer goes on, this amendment is a backdoor attempt to interfere in our constitutionally protected right to privacy, legislators and the government in between women and their doctors. Same old talking points. This isn't a backdoor attempt. This is a front door attempt. We're coming right through the front door. You know, She also says there were personhood supporters are working for a total ban on access to safe legal abortion with no exceptions. They also oppose most commonly used forms of hormonal birth control. The initiative does not reflect mainstream Montana values. And I agree with her on that point. But personhood advocates are working to change what are mainstream values. One day, protecting all innocent people from those who seek to kill them will be mainstream, even in Montana. Lord willing, and we will keep fighting for that day. All right, now, I've got a story from London. This is from the Continuing Collapse of Britain file, but it really goes for the whole world. A report says that the pill, the birth control pill, may have changed women's taste in men, according to a study. Scientists say the hormones in the oral contraceptive suppress a woman's interest in masculine men and make boyish men more attractive. Although the change occurs for just a few days each month, it may have been highly influential since use of the pill began more than 40 years ago. If the theory is right, it could partly explain the shifting in tastes from macho 1950s and 60s stars such as Kirk Douglas and Sean Connery to the more wimpy, androgynous stars of today such as Johnny Depp and Russell Brand. Dr. Alexandra Alvern of the University of Sheffield says the pill could also be altering the way women pick their mates and could have long-term implications for society. Gee, you think? It's an extremely powerful hormonal cocktail that women take every single day. You think that might have some effect? Very insightful from Dr. Alexandra Alvern. She says there are many obvious benefits of the pill for women. Is that right? But, she says, there is also the possibility that the pill has psychological side effects that we are only just discovering. The links between the pill and sexual preferences are highlighted in a paper in the journal Trends in Ecology and Evolution. Okay, so we can see that if this study does stumble across any facts or reveal anything enlightening, it will purely be by accident. There are some things that I would like to highlight in this article. Now, if women are taking the pill, they no longer have fertile days during the month, right? Okay, so during the few days each month when women are fertile, they tend to prefer masculine features and men who are more assertive. On these fertile days, women are also more attracted to men who are genetically dissimilar. Picking a partner whose genetic makeup is unlike their own increases the chances of having a healthy child. On days when women are not fertile, their tastes swing toward more feminine, boyish faces and more caring personalities, according to research. So if women are taking the pill, they no longer have fertile days. They no longer experience the hormonal changes that make them more attractive to masculine men. So past studies, according to the good doctor, have also shown that men find women more attractive around the time of ovulation, possibly because women have instinctive ways by their natural scent or behavior of alerting men that they are fertile. Yeah. Now, Dr. Alvern said the use of the pill could influence a woman's ability to attract a mate by reducing her attractiveness to men. Yeah, an increasing number of studies suggest that the pill is likely to have an impact on human mating decisions and subsequent reproduction. So here, everyone thought in the 60s that you could take this powerful cocktail of hormones and just, you know, party down, and it was just party time. But the implications are far-reaching, to say the least. And so now we know why all the queerish-looking boys are so popular in Hollywood these days. Or at least that's a partial explanation. All right, now, let's go on to in the Continuing Collapse of Britain file. From London, from Reuters, one English college is threatening to send lecturers home for violating their new dress code. So what is the radical dress code there at what school is the Birmingham Metropolitan College? Earrings must not be excessive and are the only form of jewelry allowed in visible piercings. The policy also states that tattoos must be covered. Oh, no. Is this the state of higher education in Britain? The children have taken over. The inmates are running the asylum. Nick Varney of the local university and college union branch said that the policy harks back to the Victorian times. Well, maybe you should think about that since your entire culture is collapsing around you. Everyone's turning homosexual or killing themselves. Nobody's having any kids. And you're being taken over by Muslim fundamentalists. So maybe the Victorian times don't look so bad to the average Englishman, for crying out loud. He says his staff is absolutely fuming. It's about their professionalism and the notion that they haven't got a clue about what to wear when they're teaching. Well, my guess is, you know, if they're under 30, they probably don't have a clue. They've got their piercings, they've got their tattoos, and they're mostly at school for the cruising, in my humble opinion. He says, has diversity and the celebration of cultural differences totally passed the college administration by, he asks. Well, let's hope indeed it has, if there's any hope for England now or in the future. Oh, here we go. Here we go. Dateline Olympia, Washington, from the Associated Press. Microsoft Corporation has donated $100,000 to the campaign supporting more partnership, gay partnership rights for Washington homosexual couples. Yeah. It's the largest single donation in favor of Referendum 71, which asks voters to approve or reject a new law that expands domestic partnerships for homosexual couples. Yeah. Now, listen to this. The campaign for the queers has raised $780,000 and has spent about $200,000. The campaign against the queers has raised about $60,000 and has spent more than half of that already. So why is it that the left is always seems better funded than the right? What's the deal there? I mean, here in Colorado, Planned Parenthood spent, I believe it was $3 million to defeat our little personhood amendment. And we spent, if I'm not mistaken, less than $100,000. What is the deal with the left being so much better funded than us? And don't tell me that the Republicans sometimes raise just as much as the Democrats. Because they are both on the left, okay? You know, one openly, one a little bit more subtly. But they're both on the left. Well, but the left is always better funded. I guess the truth offends too many people to bring in the really big bucks. I guess. That's one part. Well, I've been praying daily for some rich and influential people to catch the vision on personhood. I mean, we've got a lot of good-hearted people and people who have the right ideas and people who have a lot of energy, but we need some rich people. So I want to ask my audience, all 24 of you, to just pray every day, just add this to your prayer list, that rich, influential people will catch the vision of personhood so that we can fund this program. We can fund this movement. It is the most significant social movement, I believe, in the history of mankind. And we simply need to communicate that vision to more people so that we can fund it, so that we can fight our enemies on the political battlefield. It takes a lot of money, from what I understand. All right. Now, on to much more serious news. Dateline Paris from the Associated Press, a French gay soccer team says its members were victims of homophobia when a team of Muslim players refused to play a match against them. The Paris Foot gay team said that it received an email from the Créteil Bebel Muslim soccer club canceling their match. Paris Foot Gay has asked the amateur league to sanction the Muslims for being homophobes. Zahir, a spokesman for the Muslim soccer club, Zahir Balgarbi, he told French radio that he apologized if anyone felt upset or hurt. Wow. Wow. I mean, the homos can even get the Muslims to apologize to them. Is there no end to the power of the homosexual lobby? I mean, you write something negative about Mohammed and they come and cut your head off or stick a knife in you. The homos get upset and even the Muslims are apologizing. everyone. It's the Weekly Worldview. I am your host, Doug McBurney, and I am back. I'm glad to have you aboard as we round third, and we're headed for home, ladies and gentlemen, on a move to the Justice Injustice file. Typically, it's just the Justice file, but there's so much injustice in this week's file that I've had to rename the file. From Stockton, California, the Associated Press, a 23-year-old man will spend the rest of his life in jail in the death of a 13-year-old California boy who was caught in the crossfire of a gang shootout while attending a barbecue with his family. A San Joaquin County Superior Court judge sentenced 23-year-old Chance Proom to life without parole. Prosecutors say Proom fired the fatal shot that struck young Alan Kelly Jr. of Stockton. Bullet struck him in the chest on February 8th of 2008. Kelly was attending a barbecue with his family. He was shot and killed in his mother's car as she fled the scene. So what's the deal with the Associated Press saying prosecutors say that this scumbag fired the shot? This guy's already been convicted. He's been sentenced. So you can drop the prosecutors say there at the Associated Press. It's been well established that he shot and killed this boy. Anyway, Prum maintained at trial that he did not intend to shoot Kelly, but was firing at rival gang members. What I can't understand, if I'm the judge in this case, and the kid says, well, I was just shooting at some other gang members, I would say, okay, so are you admitting that you were shooting at other gang members when this young boy was caught in the crossfire? Well, yeah, but I didn't mean to kill him. Okay, and then I would have just taken him out back and pulled out my .44 and shot him right in the side of the head. That's it. You just confessed to me that you were in a gang shootout, and this boy was shot. I think that's a case for summary execution right there. Why continue the trial? Anyway, but this killer got life. Life. While the victim did not get life. Dateline Lubbock, Texas. A Texas jury sentenced a man to life in prison without parole for the 2005 slayings of a pregnant woman, her husband, and son inside their farmhouse. Yeah, you heard me right. Levi King pled guilty last month to killing Michael Conrad, her husband, to killing Michelle Conrad, her husband Brian Conrad, and her 14-year-old son Zach. And Michelle was 6 months pregnant. The Lubbock County jury had to answer two questions in order to give King the death penalty. Number one, was he a continuing threat to society? And number two, did mitigating circumstances exist that warranted mercy? This is wrong on so many levels. Could we just base the death penalty on how many people he slaughtered? Couldn't that be one question? Anyway, jurors were only able to answer yes to the first question. They agreed that he was a continuing threat to society, but they were unable to answer the second question. Did mitigating circumstances exist that warranted mercy? I'm completely at a loss. I'm at a loss here. What about mitigating circumstances that called for extreme vengeance and brutality? He killed a pregnant woman and two other people. He killed four people. How many people do you have to slaughter in the state of Texas to get the death penalty anymore? Texas is supposed to be the death penalty capital. Anyway, the details of the story are simply too shocking to go into for anyone to comprehend how this jury did not put... This proves that people chosen for juries are the stupidest people on the planet. If you are chosen for jury duty, you need to step back and reassess your life and your IQ in general. You are a moron. By the way, I have never been selected for jury duty. Never, not once. People who are selected for juries are idiots. I suppose that you could try to go in undercover and pretend you're really stupid so that you could get on the jury and try to do right. But if you're actually selected through no real effort of your own, just by your answering of their questions and, you know, how you fill out the paper, you're an idiot because they're obviously looking for idiots. All right. Speaking of idiots, speaking of people who are a continuing threat to society, Dateline New York City, the U.S. government has decided not to seek the death penalty against a Guantanamo detainee charged in the bombings of the African embassies in 1998. A letter released this past Monday advises a federal judge that Attorney General Eric Holder told prosecutors not to seek the death penalty in the trial of Ahmed Galani. His trial, by the way, is scheduled to start next year around this time. Authorities allege he was the bomb maker, the document forger, and an aide to Osama bin Laden. By the way, the attacks at the embassies in Tanzania and Kenya killed 124 people, including 12 Americans. Apparently, that's not enough in Eric Holder's mind to pursue the death penalty, because pursuing the death penalty is it's very complex. There's a lot of paperwork, and, you know, we don't want to offend the Muslims. We're trying to reach out to them. That's Barry Ho's new policy now, is he wants to befriend all the people who want to blow us up. He wants to talk, and one of the ways to open the door, open the lines of communication with our Muslim brethren is to know that if they blow us up and kill our people, we will not seek to kill their people, at least not in a court of law. This is not unbelievable. It is shocking, but not really a big surprise in any real sense of the word. Now, let's move on to this. Getting depressing, right? The justice file is really the injustice file. But here's an interesting note from Columbus, Ohio. Ohio is considering injecting lethal drugs into inmates' bone marrow or muscles as an alternative to or as a backup for the traditional intravenous execution procedure. Yeah. This is happening in the wake of the failed execution last month. You remember we reported on that here at the Weekly Worldview. You remember officials couldn't locate a vein on the inmate Rommel Broom? Yeah. They couldn't find suitable veins. I think they probably could have. They're bureaucrats. Government workers don't put in a whole lot of effort. And so, you know, after about an hour or so, they're just like, hey, can we go home? You know? But anyway, Ohio is looking to correct the problem. The main problem is, well, here's the thing with Rommel Broom there in Ohio. If you can't find a vein, I mean, you're going to execute the guy. I mean, couldn't you just pick up a metal chair and smash his head? I mean, come on. Be resourceful. Adapt. Overcome. Be innovative. I think they could have gotten that done. They just lacked the initiative and the creativity to finish that. According to Ohio officials, injecting chemicals into bone marrow with an instrument that quickly thrusts the needle through bone, or injecting them into muscle, raises the likelihood of pain. Muscles absorb drugs less quickly, and it's harder to numb bone to alleviate pain. Such techniques could lead to what one doctor referred to as the Hippocratic paradox, in which doctors are needed to oversee the procedure, but they can't do it because of ethical constraints. Yeah. So, you know, the first problem, well, first of all, the Hippocratic Oath, isn't the first part of that do no harm? Well, you know, executing a convicted killer, it's good. It does good for society. It doesn't do harm. It's even good for that person. Yeah. You tell them, look, you're convicted. You're in 3 days, you're going to meet God, your creator. Here's a Bible. You stay in this room, and we're going to kill you in 3 days. So it's good. It wouldn't violate the Hippocratic Oath in any way. Now, second, you know, a third party like a doctor should only be necessary at an execution if the victim's family just doesn't want to do it, you know. It should be the victim's family who executes the killer, and they should do it in a painful public way. It'd be very effective in, number one, it'd be a cathartic experience for the victims so they could have closure. And also, it would really scare other criminals. If, Rommel Broom, who's the subject of this story, they don't even talk about his crime in this article. You know, it's something that happened so long ago, nobody really even remembers anymore. What's the point of even talking about it, apparently, as far as the Associated Press is concerned? But, you know, if the victim's father could have grabbed a metal chair and smashed this guy's head in until he was dead, and if that was broadcast, you know, criminals would see that and they'd think twice before resorting to violence that could lead to death. I'm just so depressed with the justice file. Wait a minute, what do we have here? Dateline Atmore, Alabama. An Alabama death row inmate has been executed for the 1992 kidnap, robbery, and killing of store owner Braxton Brown. The killer's name was Max Payne, That's ironic, since he was killed by lethal injection, which is min pain. Max Payne died at 6:25 this past Thursday. And Braxton Brown, let's see, Braxton Brown died in 1992, 17 years ago. So 17 years before they gently executed Max Payne. Yeah. Well, I guess it's somewhat encouraging. At least he was executed. I suppose we can take some solace in that. Into the domestic tranquility file. A soccer mom was killed by her husband in a shooting witnessed online by her video chat partner. Scott Hain fired several shots into his 30-year-old wife, Melanie, while her video chat was active. Scott Hain later killed himself in an upstairs bedroom. The online friend heard a shot and screams and turned to see if Scott Hain was firing. Apparently they were online chatting in one of these video chat deals. Anyway, the friend says he observed Scott Hain standing over where Melanie was, discharging a handgun several times. Friends and neighbors told police that the couple had been having marital problems, but police knew of no immediate cause of the violence. Well, I can tell you one immediate cause is that the stigma for suicide has been removed. And so many weak-minded individuals, hell-bent on destruction, no longer see any reason to restrain themselves. They kill someone that they're mad at, then they kill themselves. And in our growingly atheistic culture, they think that they're just going to go on to, well, who knows what. But they don't think they're going to be judged by God. Well, that's one of the causes. There were probably some other specific causes in this case, but you know, this is an epidemic around the country. This couple had three children, ages 2, 6, and 10. A neighbor said that the children ran to another neighbor's house and said, "Daddy shot Mommy." That's the state of domestic tranquility there in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. Lincoln, Nebraska. On a lighter note, police say a woman will not face charges for throwing a dog at an officer during a domestic violence investigation. The woman was suspected of throwing a cell phone that hit her boyfriend in the face. That's why police were called. Neither the dog nor the officer were injured, but apparently the boyfriend was. The woman was arrested on suspicion of domestic assault. So what do you want to bet in both of these cases that the motivating factor, the key factor that led to one horrifying crime and one relatively innocuous stupid thing, both a direct result of sexual immorality? That's just my guess. All right, now, let's move on here. We've rounded third. We're heading for home. Do I want to do any of this faith healing stuff? Well, I suppose I'll do it. From the Philadelphia Inquirer, on the last day of Kent Scheibel's life, his parents and pastor intensely prayed over his 32-pound body, which unbeknownst to them was ravaged by bacterial pneumonia. When the two-year-old boy finally died at 9:30 inside the family's Northwest Philadelphia home, the pastor called a funeral director to take the boy's remains to the medical examiner's office. Yeah. At no time that day, nor in the week and a half prior, did the parents seek medical treatment for their son. They just prayed for a healing. Yeah. They're members of the first century gospel church in the Northeast, which believes that the sick can be healed through prayer rather than by medicine. Let's see. The pastor says, "We prayed to God for victory. We were praying that he would be raised up." And they did not seek medical attention. A tragedy. Bad religion. It's from the bad religion file. You know, I'm wondering, I'd like to get a hold of this pastor and find out, has the church leadership changed their position on the nature of healing and praying for healing? And what about the pastor? Hasn't he been arrested for participating in a crime? They killed this boy, the parents and the pastor. I don't care how they dress it up or what their theology is. They killed him. And I want to know why. The article doesn't say anything about the pastor being arrested. And I'm not sure why that is the case. Dateline Wausau, Wisconsin. A central Wisconsin couple who prayed rather than seek medical care for their 11-year-old dying daughter were sentenced last week to 6 months in jail and 10 years probation for killing their daughter. Well, you know, killing kids is not as stigmatized as it once was in this country. Dale and Lalani Newman were sentenced in the March 2008 death of Madeline Newman, their daughter. She died of undiagnosed but treatable diabetes. The case was believed to be the first, according to the Associated Press, the first of its kind in Wisconsin involving faith healing, in which someone died and another person was charged with a homicide. Well, I mean, at least the authorities there in Wausau, Wisconsin, have some connection to reality. The family relied totally on prayer for healing. The girl, known as Kara, died on the floor of the family's rural western home as people surrounded her and prayed. Someone finally called 911 after she stopped breathing. So I suppose it was that lack of faith right there, that person that called 911, who led to the girl's death. I'm sure that's what the pastor's going to preach, because how do you get past this? How do you get back in the pulpit and tell your congregation that if they just pray and agree and if they get all that unconfessed sin out of their lives, that they'll get a healing? I mean, the girl died on the floor. Dale Newman, the father, says he read from the Bible and he told the judge that he loved his daughter. He says, "I'm guilty of trusting my Lord's wisdom completely. I'm guilty of asking for heavenly intervention. I'm guilty of following Jesus Christ when the whole world does not understand. I'm guilty of obeying my God." Wow. Bad religion. I mean, these pastors should be held to account. They should be charged with murder for misleading these poor, ignorant parishioners. You know, Jesus said that it's an evil generation that seeks a sign, and none will be given to it. And he also said, "Do not tempt the Lord your God." And this pastor, well, it really upsets me. It really upsets me. But bad religion kills, probably more often than bad government. Bad religion kills. All right, folks, we are just about coming to the end of it here. And I'll tell you, I can hardly get through this without my extremely attractive audio engineer. It's tough. All right, Dateline Melbourne, Australia, from the Reuters Wire. Adult fans at one of Australia's most popular motorsports races will be limited to 24 cans of beer a day as police focus on reducing alcohol-related crime. 24 cans. You heard that right. Now, the 24-can rule has been put into place for a specific race there in the Melbourne area. The 24-can rule would also be placed on mixed drinks. Yeah. So, you know, if you need that 25th drink, don't think you can switch to scotch. More restrained spectators will be able to slake their thirst with up to 36 cans of low or mid-strength beer. 30. Okay. So, by the way, folks, here in the United States, your average beer, your Budweiser, your Coors, those are what the Australians would consider low or mid-strength beer. And so race fans are only allowed to have 36 cans of beer a day. Wine lovers must make do with no more than 4 liters of wine per day. And combinations of the options would not be allowed, according to police. Police respect people's rights to enjoy the race weekend, but will promptly act when the law is broken. So there's no details as to how they're going to monitor 3,000 people and figure out how much they drink. But let me just posit the idea that if you're reaching for that 25th beer, then maybe the race isn't really what it's all about for you. That's it. That's the Weekly Worldview this week. I want to thank KGov Radio, Denver Bible Church, Personhood USA, American Right to Life, my friends over at TheologyOnline.com, and, of course, my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. I'll be back with you next week, and until then, May the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.